Greetings, Saints! Welcome to Word Study with Brother Hebert. This is part 12 of Devil, Satan, Serpent. You can follow along with the article by going to www.thinkoutsidethebeast.com. Devil, Satan, Serpent can be found on the main menu. Over the last several messages, we've uncovered a truth that has long been buried beneath church tradition and Jewish fables. The Bible does not describe the devil as a singular supernatural being like in the movies. Instead, it uses the term devil, diabolos in the Greek, to highlight the characteristics of a person who is ungodly, slanderous, rebellious, or opposed to truth. Someone who is self-conscious instead of God-conscious. The devil is not a proper name. It's not even a title. It's a description, a label applied to those who reflect the spiritual traits of darkness. Judas was called a devil, not because he was possessed, but because he was a betrayer. John 6:70. Paul warned that in the last days, people would be false accusers, diaboloi, living selfish, ungodly lives. 2 Timothy 3:3. Even church leaders and their wives were told not to be diabolos, not gossips or slanderers, 1 Timothy 3:11 and Titus 2:3. In other words, devil in Scripture is simply a word to describe someone living contrary to God, a person driven by the flesh, the carnal mind, and rebellion. And that brings us to the heart of the issue, quite literally. In our final message on all the devil verses, we saw that the real battlefield is the heart. The Bible teaches that the heart is the seat of thoughts, emotions, will, and desire. It's where sin begins, where rebellion is born, and where either truth or deception takes root. Proverbs 4:23 says, "Guard your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the issues of life." Jeremiah says, "The heart is deceitful above all things, and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" Jesus said, "Out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications." The serpent in Eden was not an external devil. It was Eve's own carnal reasoning, her desire to be wise apart from God. The devil we fear is often just the desires we feed, the pride we justify, and the lies we tell ourselves. So we end the devil study with this. The devil is not out there. The devil is in here, in the unrepentant heart, in the carnal mind, in the institutions, airwaves, denominational churches, world systems, and voices that oppose the truth of God and His kingdom. And now, we shift to the next layer of this study, Satan. If devil, diabolos, describes the character of a person acting in opposition to God, then Satan, Satan, describes the role or function as or of an adversary. Satan means opponent, enemy, resister, and it's used for men, nations, angels, and even God Himself. It's not a proper name. It's not a red figure with horns, wings, and a tail. It's whoever or whatever stands against the will and work of God. So as we look carefully at each verse where Satan appears, let the scriptures speak for themselves. No superstitions, no traditions, just truth. Now let's examine the Satan. Satan, H 7854 and G 4567, is a metaphor for the role of an adversary opposing God's kingdom and truth, represented by corrupt political systems, religious leaders, and human adversaries who resist righteousness rather than a literal satanic being. The Church's role in misinterpreting Satan. A persistent challenge for many Christians, especially those transitioning from traditional Judeo-Christian doctrines and the Cain-Satanic dual seedline doctrine, is overcoming ingrained misconceptions about Satan, the dragon, and the devil. These terms are often understood as referring to a singular, supernatural being with horns and a tail. However, that such imagery is symbolic, not literal, and that Satan is better understood as an adversary. False doctrines of Satan. Ministers have perpetuated doctrines of a supernatural Satan responsible for all evil, diverting attention from human accountability and systemic injustice. That Satan is the ruler of a fiery underworld where souls are punished eternally. Examples of false doctrines: the belief in a future singular Antichrist, the rapture doctrine, absolving Christians from earthly responsibility, Satan as a scapegoat for human sins. Consequences of misinterpretation. These doctrines obscure the true nature of evil, preventing Christians from identifying and opposing the real enemies, corrupt systems and individuals. Understanding the word Satan. The term Satan literally means adversary or opponent. It is not a proper name but a descriptor. Biblical references include Satan in the Old Testament, H. 78:54, appears as an adversary, including instances where God himself is referred to as a Satan, for example in Numbers 22:22 and 1 Chronicles 21:1. In the New Testament, the Greek equivalent, G. 45:67, continues the meaning of adversary without implying a supernatural being. Key points. The transliteration Satan fosters a dualistic concept of good and evil gods. This idea, rooted in pagan traditions, contradicts monotheistic biblical doctrine, Deuteronomy 5:7, Isaiah 44:24. Not a proper name. In the Old Testament, Satan refers to human or national adversaries. For example, Numbers 22:22, the angel of the Lord is described as a Satan, an adversary to Balaam. In 1 Samuel 29:4, David is called a Satan to the Philistines. Source of evil. Scripture identifies the human heart as the origin of evil. Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Matthew 15:19, Jesus explains that evil thoughts and actions stem from within. This negates the need for an external Satan as the source of sin. Blaming a supernatural adversary avoids personal accountability. Adversaries as Satan in Scripture. Throughout Scripture, Satan consistently describes opposition rather than a being. Examples include Peter. Jesus called him Satan when Peter resisted God's plan, Matthew 16:22 and 23. David, seen as a Satan by the Philistines, 1 Samuel 29:4. And God, acted as a Satan, an adversary to Israel, 1 Chronicles 21:1, paralleled in 2 Samuel 24:1. The term adversary highlights relational and covenantal opposition to God rather than a singular supernatural figure. Evil as consequence, not entity. Evil is not a substance or entity, but the result of disobedience to God's laws. Deuteronomy 28, blessings for obedience and curses for rebellion. James 1:13-15, every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then, when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. Evil exists in wrong relationships with God. Redemption through Jesus Christ restores these relationships, as emphasized in 1 John 3:8. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Misconceptions about Satan. Church traditions and two seed line doctrines have personified Satan, promoting dualistic beliefs rooted in Babylonian and Judaic influences. Key misconceptions include Lucifer. Found in Isaiah 14:12, Lucifer refers to the fall of Babylon, not a supernatural being. Translations like Morning Star or Shining One clarify its symbolic nature. The temptation of Jesus, Matthew 4:1-11. Jesus' temptations represent challenges to his faithfulness, not a literal dialogue with Satan. He was tempted as we are, Hebrews 4:15. Revelation symbols. Terms like dragon, serpent, and beast symbolize adversarial systems or powers, not individual entities. Revelation 12:9 and 20:1-3. The occult and false doctrines. Occult practices, witchcraft, sorcery, symbolize rebellion and twisting of God's laws. Deuteronomy 18:10-12, 1 Samuel 15:23. These practices deceive and enslave individuals through false doctrines and illusions of power. The sovereignty of God. Blaming Satan diminishes God's absolute sovereignty. Deuteronomy 5:7, Isaiah 45:7. Scripture teaches God creates consequences for disobedience. Isaiah 54:16, Judges 9:23. Redemption is through Jesus Christ, not escape from a rival deity. Responsibility and accountability. The Bible unequivocally emphasizes personal responsibility for actions. Each individual is accountable for what is done in the body, with consequences determined at the judgment seat of Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians 5:10. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he has done, whether it be good or bad. This teaching contrasts with common church traditions that deem actions or works irrelevant after being justified by faith,
just believe,
and attribute evil to a supernatural figure, Satan, shifting blame from human responsibility.
Oh, I'm saved.
These interpretations misrepresent Scripture and obscure the true nature of sin and its consequences. So, what is Satan? The true source of evil. Scripture repeatedly identifies the human heart as the origin of sin and evil. Old Testament witness. Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Genesis 8:21.
The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth.
New Testament confirmation. Matthew 15:19. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. Evil arises from wrong choices, rebellion, and disobedience to God's law, not from an external supernatural force. Blaming Satan perpetuates denial of personal accountability, a trend mirrored in society, where individuals seek to shift blame for their actions. Satan in the Old Testament. The Hebrew word Satan, H. 7854, Satan, means adversary or opponent. Its usage in the Old Testament refers to mortal men and rulers, or God's angels, acting in opposition, and even God himself, not a supernatural entity. Numbers 22:20. And God came to Balaam at night, and said unto him,
If the men come to call you, rise up and go with them. But the word which I shall say unto you, that shall you do.
God permits Balaam to accompany Balak's messengers, but stipulates that Balaam must only speak what God commands. Despite this clear directive, Balaam's eagerness for the promised rewards leads him to act hastily. Verse 21. And Balaam rose up in the morning and saddled his ass and went with the princes of Moab. Instead of waiting for the messengers to call him in the morning, as God instructed, Balaam takes the initiative and goes to them, demonstrating a willful disregard for God's specific conditions. This premature action reflects Balaam's internal struggle between obedience to God's command and his desire for personal gain. Verse 22, And God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of Yahweh stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now he was riding upon his ass, and his two servants were with him. Here we see an angel of the Lord is called a Satan, an adversary to Balaam. A similar instance is in Exodus 4:24, where God confronts Moses on his journey due to the disobedience or neglect of his commands, the circumcising of his son. Moses' neglect of circumcision stemmed from his wife's resistance. Circumcision was new to the Midianites, making him unfit to lead and incurring divine wrath, as circumcision was a binding covenant, and his failure jeopardized his mission. He was held accountable for his family's disobedience. God's anger arises not merely from the act of going, but from Balaam's underlying intentions. His heart is set on the riches and honor promised by Balak, indicating a covetous motive. The donkey's repeated attempts to avoid the angel, turning aside, pressuring against the wall, and finally lying down, highlight her awareness of the danger ahead. Each action results in Balaam's increasing frustration and harsh treatment of the animal. This sequence emphasizes Balaam's spiritual blindness and impatience, contrasting sharply with the donkey's sensitivity to the divine presence. Isaiah 1:3.
The ox knows his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider.
Numbers, verse 32. And the angel of Yahweh said unto him,
Wherefore have you smitten your ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand you, because your way is perverse before me.
The angel questions Balaam, highlighting the unjust treatment of his donkey and pointing out the perverse nature of Balaam's journey. The term perverse here reflects Balaam's deviation from righteous intentions, driven by covetousness and a desire to align with Balak's wishes, contrary to God's command. This confrontation serves as a divine correction, emphasizing that while Balaam outwardly professed obedience, his heart harbored conflicting desires. 2 Peter 2:14, having eyes full of adultery, and that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls, and heart they have exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. In verse 32, withstand is Satan, H. 78:54. The angel of Yahweh was an adversary to Balaam. The angel explains that the donkey's actions saved Balaam from death, as the angel would have slain him for his disobedience. Balaam, realizing his sin, offers to return home. However, the angel permits him to continue, but reiterates that he must only speak what God commands. This directive serves as both a warning and a reminder of Balaam's prophetic duty to convey God's words faithfully, without succumbing to external temptations. This passage serves as a profound lesson on the dangers of allowing personal desires to overshadow divine directives. Balaam's experience underscores the importance of aligning one's heart and actions with God's will, highlighting that true prophetic insight requires both spiritual awareness and unwavering obedience. In 1 Samuel 1:1-20, we encounter the poignant story of Hannah, a woman deeply distressed by her inability to conceive children. Married to Elkanah, who also had another wife, Peninnah, Hannah faces constant provocation and ridicule from Peninnah due to her barrenness. This ongoing torment exacerbates Hannah's sorrow, leading her to fervent prayer and a vow to dedicate her child to the Lord if he grants her a son. God hears her plea, and she gives birth to Samuel, whom she dedicates to God's service. 1 Samuel 1:6. And her adversary, Peninnah, her rival wife, also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because Yahweh had shut up her womb. And he did so year by year. Whenever she went up to the house of Yahweh, Peninnah provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. This term adversary underscores the role Peninnah plays in exacerbating Hannah's emotional turmoil. Verse 8. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am not I better to you than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by the doorpost of the temple of Yahweh. And she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto Yahweh, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Yahweh of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid, and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man-child, then I will dedicate him unto Yahweh all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. Samuel was going to be a Nazir, a dedicated or devoted one, under the laws of the Nazirite. Verse 12. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before Yahweh, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long will you be drunken? Put away your wine from you. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before Yahweh. Count not your handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. This verse suggests that strange or ecstatic behavior was associated with impurity and pagan cults. Daughter of Belial, a scripture phrase for a wicked person. Thus, when we are unjustly censored, we should endeavor not only to clear ourselves, but to satisfy our brethren by giving them a just and true account of what they misapprehended. Verse 17. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Yisrael grant you your petition that you have asked of him. And she said, Let your handmaid find grace in your sight. So the woman went her way, and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And they rose up in the morning early, and worshipped before Yahweh, and returned, and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Yahweh remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of Yahweh. Hannah's adversary was a rival wife, not Satan. Other examples include Leviticus 18:18.
Neither shall you take a wife to her sister to vex her.
This verse warns against marrying two sisters to prevent rivalry and vexation, paralleling the strife seen between Hannah and Peninnah. Job 24:21, He evil entreateth the barren that beareth not. This passage speaks to the cruelty faced by barren women, reflecting Peninnah's harsh treatment of Hannah. Genesis 30, 1. And when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister. Similar to Hannah's plight, Rachel experiences envy and distress due to her barrenness, leading to familial tension. Job 6:14. To him that is afflicted, pity should be showed from his friend. This verse emphasizes the expectation of compassion towards those in distress, contrasting with Peninnah's antagonistic behavior. These cross-references provide a broader biblical context for understanding the societal and personal challenges associated with barrenness and the added anguish caused by adversarial relationships. The Philistines gather their armies to Aphek to fight against Israel, while the Israelites encamp by a spring in Jezreel. As the Philistine leaders review their troops, they notice David and his men marching at the rear with Achish, the Philistine king of Gath. The Philistine commanders question Achish about David's presence, recalling his past allegiance to Saul and his reputation as a formidable warrior. Achish, however, defends David, stating he has found no fault in him since he defected to the Philistines. 1 Samuel 29:4. And the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him, and the princes of the Philistines said unto him, Make this fellow return, that he may go again to his place which you have appointed him, and let him not go down with us to the battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us. For wherewith he should reconcile himself unto his master, will it not be with the heads of those men? The Philistine commanders strongly oppose David's inclusion in the battle, fearing that he may turn against them to regain Saul's favor. They refer to David as a potential adversary, H. 7854, Satan, a term that in Hebrew simply means opponent or accuser, rather than the later developed concept of Satan as an evil entity. In 2 Samuel 19:22, after Abishai suggests executing Shimei for cursing David, the king responds by rebuking Abishai and his brother Joab, the sons of Zeruiah. 2 Samuel 19:22, And David said, What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be adversaries unto me? Shall there any man be put to death this day in Yisrael? For do not I know that I am this day king over Yisrael? David calls his own men Satans, adversaries, when they oppose his decisions. David emphasizes that this day, marking his restoration as king over Israel, should not be tainted by acts of vengeance or bloodshed. He implies that such actions would be counterproductive, potentially inciting further unrest among the people. By choosing mercy over retribution, David seeks to unify the nation and solidify his reign, demonstrating a leadership style that prioritizes reconciliation over punishment. The Census of Israel. 2 Samuel 24:1. And again the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Yisrael, and he moved David against them to say, Go, number Israel and Judah. 1 Chronicles 21:1. And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. Note, it was God who moved David. It is parallel to the passage in 1 Chronicles, which states God was an Satan, an opponent. David's motivation might have stemmed from pride or a desire to expand his dominion without seeking divine guidance, leading him to rely on military strength rather than God's providence. Verse 2, For the king said to Joab, the captain of the host, which was with him, Go now through all the tribes of Yisrael, from Dan even to Beersheba, and number you the people, that I may know the number of the people. Numbering the fighting men, not all the people. This command reflects David's desire to assess the nation's military capabilities. This perspective suggests that David's trust shifted from God to human resources. Verse 3, And Joab said unto the king, Now Yahweh your God add unto the people, how many soever they be, an hundredfold, and that the eyes of my lord the king may see it. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing? Notwithstanding, the king's word prevailed against Joab, and against the captains of the host. And Joab and the captains of the host went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Yisrael. The census, verses 1 through 9, David orders Joab to number Israel. The pestilence, verses 10 through 17, God punishes Israel with a plague as a result of the census. The altar on Araunah's threshing floor, verses 18 through 25, David builds an altar to atone and halt the plague. The census leads to divine punishment. Exodus 30, 12 through 15 establishes that censuses required a ransom to avoid plagues. A king can never count heads, but rather he should require every person to give a half shekel and then count the coins. By doing so, the people avoid affliction because anyone counted is subject to an evil eye and thus susceptible to plague, as happened here. The altar and its atoning ritual, offering sacrifices, serve as the resolution to the pestilence, similar to Aaron offering incense to stop a plague in Numbers 17:6 through 15. The incident of numbering Israel underscores the dangers of pride and reliance on human strength over divine guidance. The distinction between divine permission and carnal incitement is vital, reminding believers to seek God's will and avoid the pitfalls of self-sufficiency. David's actions were antithetical to the type of thought we find presented in Deuteronomy 20:1 through 4. Israel was to trust in God, not large numbers. David's decision to assess just how many men who drew the sword throughout Israel may have been seen by other Israelites as a failure to trust in God. Looking back at verse 1, where God is called a Satan, Lamentations 3:38, Do not the evils and the good come out of the mouth of the Most High? 1 Kings 5:4, Solomon saying to Hiram, But now Yahweh my God has given me rest on every side, so that there is neither adversary nor evil occurrent. Solomon was saying that he had no opponent, adversary, Satan. He was at peace, for now. God raises up Hadad the Edomite as a Satan, an adversary, against Solomon. In 1 Kings 11:9-14, the narrative details God's displeasure with Solomon due to his heart turning away from the Lord, leading to the rise of adversaries against his kingdom. Solomon's deviation from exclusive worship of God, influenced by his foreign wives, incited divine anger. This was especially grievous as God had appeared to Solomon twice, offering guidance and warnings. These divine appearances rendered Solomon inexcusable in his idolatry. Such direct encounters with God heightened the severity of Solomon's transgressions. 1 Kings 11:14, And Yahweh stirred up an adversary unto Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the king's seed in Edom. And God stirred up to Solomon another adversary, Rezon the son of Eliada, an Aramite Syrian, which fled from his lord Hadadezer, king of Zobah. And he gathered men unto him, and became captain over a band, when David slew them of Zobah. And they went to Damascus, and dwelt therein, and reigned in Damascus. and he was an adversary to Israel all the days of Solomon, beside the mischief that Hadad did. And he abhorred Israel, and reigned over Syria. God stirred up Hadad and Rezon against Solomon as adversaries, not supernatural Satans. Deuteronomy 28:47-48 warns that disobedience to God would lead to the rise of adversaries, exemplified in Solomon's experience. Throughout Scripture, as we've seen so far here in the Old Testament, the word Satan simply means adversary and is applied to various human and divine figures, not a supernatural being. In Numbers 22, the angel of Yahweh is called a Satan to Balaam, showing that even God's messenger can stand in opposition when correcting disobedience. In 1 Samuel 1, Peninnah is Hannah's adversary, provoking her out of jealousy, a personal rival, not a devil. David is called a Satan by the Philistines in 1 Samuel 29, because they fear he may turn against them in battle. In 2 Samuel 19, David calls his own men Satans when they oppose his merciful decision towards Shimei. In 1 Chronicles 21:1, God himself is the Satan who provokes David to number Israel, paralleled with 2 Samuel 24, where God's anger moves David to act. And in 1 Kings 11, God raises up Hadad and Rezon as Satans, national adversaries sent to oppose Solomon due to his unfaithfulness. In all cases, Satan is never a fallen angel or cosmic Hollywood villain, but simply anyone or anything standing in opposition to God and kingdom, whether righteous or wicked. Just like in Scripture, Billy Joe Shaver isn't talking to some red devil with horns. He's confronting the real adversary, the carnal mind, the voice of temptation, the part of us that resists God's will. His bold cry, "Get thee behind me, Satan!" is the same call we must make when faced with opposition, whether it comes from within or without. It's a simple, powerful reminder. The adversary only has power when we let it speak.
Get thee behind me, Satan. See myself, the demons that were in me had turned me wrong side out. I knew inside my soul I was headed straight for hell, but I couldn't for my life figure how to help myself. And I said, get deep behind me, Satan. I knew that I
Sin lies at the door, unto you shall be his submission, and you shall rule over it